Create Art Podcast on Giant's Shoulders with Joel Chacho. Hello, friend. This is Timothy Kimo Bryan, your head instigator here at Create Art Podcast. And I have over 20 years of arts experience in multiple disciplines. My passion is to help you break through whatever is stopping you from creating more than you consume. Now, today is part two of a conversation with Joel of the Hack Sessions podcast. We were talking about one of our favorite poets, T.S. Eliot. And we titled this conversation On Giant Shoulders because we're both influenced by this giant in the poetry world. We are each putting one half of the conversation on our respective podcast. Joel puts his podcast out on Tuesday. And I'm a Saturday guy. Now, if you're coming over from Joel's show, I want to welcome you into our show. And I know that you're in for a treat as we continue this conversation. Now, if you're one of my folks, by all means, head on over to Joel's show. You can get it directly by going to his Libsyn page, hacksessionspodcast.libsyn.com. Or you can type in the Hack Session into most any podcast player. Now, without further ado, enjoy part two of On Giant Shoulders with Joe Chacho of the Hack Sessions podcast and our conversation on T.S. Eliot.
As a little aside, one thing I failed to ask you is if you're okay with vulgarity, but you can beep it out on your podcast if you like.
I am good with vulgarity.
All right, cool. I just let a few things fly, and there's going to be more. One thing that what you said kind of touched me in a way was reminded me of another thing. I have to pep talk myself a lot, and maybe a lot of people have this a similar kind of mode of existence where it's not a split in my personality, but when I'm really suffering under the weight of my of a prison of my own making, when it comes to feeling like I'm a hack or just I'm just terrible at writing, or I'm writing too much like T.S. Eliot, Dylan Thomas, Sylvia Plath, or whatever, whoever I'm absorbing right now, right? Mm-hmm. The one thing that always gets through to me is write the shitty version first. Mm-hmm. Get all of it out. If nothing else, it's like consider it like a purge. And maybe once you get that out, the only thing that's going to be left is you'll see in the regurgitated, you know, like dried poetry vomit on whatever surface you or person you just spewed it on, you'll mm-hmm. go, oh, wait a second, that looks kind of neat. I never put that, you know, that use that randomness. And then your artistic voice mm-hmm. actually makes sense, makes order out of something that you thought was shit, you know, and mm-hmm. and that's why I say it's like I have a friend whose lifelong dream was to become a screenwriter, and he finally saved the money, paid off debt, and moved out to LA, and mm-hmm. he's doing it now, and he's making his way. It's tough. It's a really hard thing to do out there, and he really wanted to get his first screenplay finished before he got out there, and he sent me every draft, every revision, and I read the first completed draft, and I think he's done one more after that. But in the process, I remember that's how I came up with the whole write the shitty version first. He was like, he was just going in circles and circles round and round, and he had a good idea and he was really excited about it, and then he would just get stuck in this negative feedback loop of I don't know, he's so left brain in a lot of ways that he spent most of his formation as a screenwriter learning the theory and all the philosophy and all the different ways you can do that. And mm-hmm. he just would stall out at the certain part in his script. I can't figure out the one rising event that leads to the this, and all this technical language was coming out. And I was like, dude, just write the shit version first. Mm-hmm. And he loved it. It like got through to him. I was like, ah,
it's like there
I
you said, go.
I was like, my one contribution. And so I think that applies to every artist is embrace the community, the brotherhood, the sisterhood, the humanity, the collective experience experience of being that we all share. I mean, it's in the Bible. There's nothing new under the sun. Mm-hmm. I know that there's stuff in the Tao Te Ching, which was a very important book in my early poeting. Mm-hmm. And it's conclusions that are drawn by nearly everyone of every philosophy, every political, philosophical. They just dress it up in different words.
Mm-hmm.
And the words sometimes determine their tribe, but that's another conversation. The language, but you're absolutely right. And that's, I want to thank you, because that's really, it's good to hear from outside yourself that, you know, it's okay to sound like someone you're very fond of, or sound like someone you're inspired by. Mm-hmm. In a way, that's how they live on too.
Absolutely.
And that's what they were doing too. It's just history is isolated them.
Well, like you've titled, you know, this whole talk that we're doing here, you know, on the shoulders, they had to stand on the shoulders of somebody else, and then they had to stand on the shoulders of somebody else. I just recently had a experience with my nephew. He moved out here from Wisconsin, and he's. How much younger is he than I am? Almost 20 years younger than I am. I was an influence on him when he was a kid growing up. A bad influence, I will admit. Mm. But I was an influence on him.
Shame.
I know. But, you know, my sister still loves me. I'm her favorite brother. And you know, there we go. He had visited me in Chicago when I was living out there for a while, and he had saw some of the poetry slams that I participated in, and he saw like one or two of those, which were not my best stuff. And then recently he moved out here, and now he runs a poetry reading. Twice a week. He does it on Wednesday and Friday nights. And, you know, Friday night is for me is laundry night. So, as we're discussing this, I'm doing laundry, but that's okay. But, he saw me, I came out to support him on Wednesday night, and he's like, "Hey, Tim, you know, you're going to read your stuff. And I'm like, "Yeah, sure. Okay." And, I saw him read, and, he does more of a hip hop kind of thing, which is fantastic. But then I read a couple of older pieces of mine, and he just was like, "Whoa, wait a minute." He's like, "I read like that too." And he pulled out a few of his stuff that isn't, you know, really hip hop-ish, and he started reading it. And then everyone's like, "Are you two related?" I'm like, "Well, yeah, you know, he's my nephew, I'm his uncle. Yeah, we're a little bit related. Yeah, a little bit." But I got a chance to see, him standing on my shoulders, which is a wonderful thing, because I know I was an influence. I know I was a bad influence, but he's a good kid. He's doing okay. But it's when we see that, when we see those that are coming after us carrying the torch, carrying the banner of whatever art form you're into, whether it be poetry, hip hop, painting, music, whatever it is, and seeing that happen and going, "All right, I must be doing something right, because I have at least one person that's influenced by me." I know I have more than that, but, you know, I have one person that lives in my basement that is influenced by me, that it really makes me go, "Yes, I'm on the right path." So if I ever wonder, if you ever wonder if you're on the right path, see if somebody is not necessarily copying, not plagiarizing you, but is influenced by what you do. And if you have one person that's influenced by what you're doing, you're probably on a good path. And you just keep on going that path, and more people will follow.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, in a way, it's another kind of relation, way that humans are related, is through ideas and through, you know, we have the blood, the physical, the tangible, but when it comes to inspiration, that's the thing that blurs the line between the physical reality and whatever else might, you know, exist. Mm-hmm. And that's, in a way, I've kind of borrowed this from a poet friend of mine. He has a good friend of mine has a fondness and affinity and affection, almost an obsession with the poet David White. I don't know if you know him. He's a very spiritual. He's definitely. I don't know much about him. I've only heard stuff of him because my friend has read it, and he's got a way of making just the ordinary, plain observations of nature, life, in plain language that all of a sudden blossoms into this beautiful, mystical reflection of things. It's really cool style that I'm going to get into him eventually. So my friend loves David White, refers to him as his papa poet.
Mm-hmm.
And I take that, and so I claim T.S. Eliot as my papa poet. He got there first. He was, in a way, it's almost accidental, just like our real fathers. It's like we are just their sons, just because him and our mother had sex and the right things happen boom, there we are, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's humor in that. There's absurdity in that. There's profound value in that too, because that's the way that life goes on. But then there's also this other way, that this other parallel stream of inspiration and ideas and deep movement of your inner being, basically, whatever that is. And I'm the kind of person that I will stutter, not because I'm reluctant to identify in language that kind of ephemeral, ethereal quality of life, but it's just because all of the words that I've heard to describe that are adequate and completely insufficient at the same time, and I love them all. So I want to use them all at the same time, but there's not a word for that. And when it comes to being inspired by the poets that we are closest to and perhaps even closely related to, That's as close to blood as we'll get, is that kind of thing. So you might as well put it into ink. Turn that blood into ink, or ink is going by the wayside with the way technology is going. But right, into finger taps typing.
Oh yeah.
Whatever you want to say.
Well, I can say, back in my day, you went to the poetry reading, you had your steno notepad, you had, your ink. My hands were always covered with ink. And, I go to the poetry readings now. Everyone's looking at their phone. They're pulling up their apps and pulling up the documents and reading it through that. I've tried to do that. No, I did that one time. And I'm like, I like to have the feel, the tactile feel of the paper. I like to feel the indentation in the paper underneath it. So that way I know, I chiseled this into a piece of paper, it, like Moses and the Ten Commandments with the stones, I chiseled this out. That's the blood, sweat, and tears. And kind of reminds me of the movie Quills and one of my other favorite authors, Marquis de Sade. He literally took his feces and his blood, and because they took everything else away, and he wrote with that. Now, I am not 100% sure that is gospel truth, but with the passion and the insanity that he had, I can buy into it. I can go, okay, yeah. He felt that he had to get all this stuff out of his head and onto a piece of paper. And why not use what you have available to you?
Yeah.
But anytime anyone says, turn the ink into blood and all that, I'm like, instantly goes to Quills and my good guy, Marquis de Sade.
Wow. Well, I had not heard that. I'm going to do some research after we're done with this episode. I don't know if there's any, I'm at this point, the only other thing that I can think of that we wanted to cover in terms of all the things we could talk about with T.S. Eliot have been covered for this installment for sure. Mm-hmm. But we did we want to bring up the recent T.S. Eliot news? It seems like it could go that way.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let's toss that in here.
So you shared an article with me recently in our emails leading up to this, the recording of this episode, and I read it. I was very, very intrigued for on a lot of levels because I'm not a man that you can – I don't want to be pinned down on in any kind of camp or tribe unless I decide that I'm in that camp or tribe. You don't do that for me. I'll do that myself. And I read this article and – I immediately shared it with a few people. My father was one of them, and each person represented a different way to take this article. Why don't you go ahead and tell me about this because you sent it to me?
Well, just recently, because it's 50 years after the death of T.S. Eliot. He had written letters to a young lady that he had, expressed an interest in, love letters. I think we've all done those. I've written lots of love letters and love poems to women that I had no intention of ever marrying, but, you know, there you go. It was a long correspondence that they had, and he had a certain agreement that, he doesn't want these released until 50 years after he's passed on. And so there's a article, and it was from a feminist magazine that was discussing T.S. Eliot under the lens of kind of the Me Too movement on how, you know, hey, he was married, but he's still given, you know, he's still, you know, corresponding with this gal. And then later, you know, the first marriage the wife was mentally unstable, is a polite way of putting it, and was institutionalized and passed away. And then he married again and, he married a woman much younger than him. And so they were, in the article, they were, kind of having a lot of issues with that. And it was all, not the whole article, but a good chunk of it was under the lens of the current Me Too movement that we had, that we're going through and that we have right now, which, I'm not passing judgment on that. I think that the Me Too movement has brought awareness and attention in my own life. As a person, to be more aware of, not to censor myself, but to be more aware of what I'm doing, my motivations, and to, to be aware of it and then to recognize it and to go, okay, yeah, that viewpoint is kind of very base and, it has, no purpose in today's, in today's world. There's poems that I have that I don't want to say that I'm embarrassed of, but would I have my kids read them even after they're turning 18? Probably not, because they were written in a dark place. But if they wanted to read them and they wanted to talk to me about them, that's fantastic. I'll talk to them about them, say, hey, I was in this dark place. This is what was going on in my life. Boom, there you go. Unfortunately, T.S. Eliot's been dead for 50 years, so he can't really comment on, the Me Too lens that he's being viewed under. I don't want to excuse anything that he did or said, because that's not my place to excuse him for it. I passed it on to you because we were talking about T.S. Eliot, and this just popped up into one of my news feeds. And I don't want to say as you can tell, I'm very conflicted about it, because I don't want to say it's an unfair article. We can look at his stuff in the Me Too movement lens, but I think we need to temper that with understanding that it is a different time and he doesn't have a chance to defend himself. Explain himself. It made me think of T.S. Eliot through that lens, and it still gives me an appreciation for him, because I look at it, and, you know, with what he had to go through with his first wife and with the insecurities that you have when you are that age, when you're in your early, you know, late teens, early 20s, early 30s, there's a lot of insecurity. I'm 47. I still have insecurities. Folks, it doesn't get better the older you get. it doesn't. But, you know, he can't justify himself, he can't defend himself against this. And I think we just need to take that with a grain of salt. I still appreciate him. I'm still going to read him. And, you know, I'm going to pass him on to other folks. And if somebody is not going to read him because they're viewing him in this lens, I think, I don't want to say they're doing a disservice to themselves, but I think they are missing out on something that can be very profound for them. If they, Charles Bukowski, perfect example, womanizer. He does not apologize for it. He is a drunk. He is a womanizer. He is a piece of crap. If I were to meet him on the street, I would think he was a piece of crap. But man, can the guy write? He gets, for me, you know, I was working class all my life. He really gets that mentality. And sometimes I want to wallow in that mentality for a minute or two. And then I get out of that and I come out of my man cave. I go upstairs and look at my wife and my kids and I go, yeah, I can't get away with that in front of them. But I can go in my man cave and go, I can, you know, grunt out and be okay with that.
Yeah, it's my reaction to this article is conflicted as well, I guess is a good concise way to put it. I have a real big problem with the seeming inability to integrate some nuance and the ability that humans do have. It is a skill I think you can hone. Some people are more adept at it than others, but to basically embrace the graded absurdity of life as it stands and the complications that rise as in all these individuals living together on the spinning globe, right? That's just a destined recipe for every possible thing you could every possible outcome to happen and happen over and over again. And it seems to be fueled by the look at me quality of social media and 24-hour news cycles where you have to have a soundbite. And the way that's sticking right now is get people outraged. And I resist that. And at the same time, I'm not immune to that. I'm not setting myself apart because I get pulled in by that every once in a while too. Mm-hmm. And I looked up, I brought up the article that you sent me, and the feminist that is mentioned in this is writing on CNN. Her name is Rafia Zakaria.
Yeah,
I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Right, and she wrote an essay. It says in her essay, Zakaria argues that the letters reveal Eliot to be an abusive misogynist. The letters tell a story not of a sensitive poet, but of a man who cannot believe that a woman has the temerity to challenge his version of the story of his life. And I'm like, whoa, dagger. I was like, I mean, first of all, I actually have a little bit of admiration for just the scathing, like, blow that they're trying, that she's basically administering to the legacy and image of that figure in history known as T.S. Eliot. However, I always come to this point just when I start to feel like I'm getting my opinions gathered and organized and trying to take a side on an issue like this. Mm-hmm. I go, look at the information I'm getting. We're talking about letters that I haven't read. And deeply personal letters, so deep that he actually insisted that they wait 50 years to read them, to open them. And we're getting information, what is it, like once, twice, three times more removed.
Mm-hmm.
We also know just by being humans ourselves that every human comes with biases. There's things called confirmation. There's such a thing as confirmation bias. And it's comforting to find stuff that reinforces your already held positions, right? And at the same time, we do like being challenged, and we do like having some sort of clear idea of what's right and what's wrong. But we always come up against the stark fact that life is a little more graded and more of a spectrum. We're talking about spectrum now in terms of, you know, the spectrum of sexuality or gender, you know, the gender spectrum and all this kind of stuff. And the joke, even in the gay community, like me and my wife run a drag show, and what's one thing that every queen says almost every week, every show that we've had, is they make some sort of crack at adding more letters to the LGBTQ, TYZ, whatever, him, her, he, she, mm-hmm. thing. They're all poking fun at that because we recognize this quality of existence is that it's always going to outpace our language. But then again, we only stick to language and tribe to start talking about things as complex as this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say it all on the record, and you can highlight this for whatever purposes, but I actually resent the fact that I just by approaching in some circles saying we need to talk about this with nuance or recognize that it's complicated, he's not there to defend himself, that in some ways that would be automatically treated as sympathizing with mm-hmm. something that isn't good. And I'm like, no, you can recognize the things that aren't good. Like objectively, if he mistreated people, and if we can look at how his relationships unfolded with these various women of his life that he was involved with, you can absolutely say, TS, that was effed up. That was seriously, what would you, mm-hmm. like you're going to have a conversation. But you can also at the same time say that doesn't diminish the quality of his work. It might personally for people make mm-hmm. them not be able to go back to it or approach it in the same way, if at all. But I'll leave you with a perfect musical example. In mm-hmm. opera houses, still to this day, we play Wagner, and he was a known Hitler supporter.
Yeah.
He was it was an anti-Semite.
Mm-hmm.
And he is one of the greatest opera composers ever. His music's gorgeous. It's Kill the Rabbit. It's, you know, Flight of the Valkyries. No one can approach that. He is a behemoth. His reputation in the body of his work alone has yet to be really followed up, and who knows if it will ever happen. Mm-hmm. So that's my little rant. Sorry. And I think this adds a sense of, it actually adds depth that is comforting from the lens that where I started, where I was like, he had this reputation that T.S. Eliot had this reputation that preceded him of being this mystical titan.
Mm-hmm.
And look at this guy. He was writing a woman. Yeah, he had a complicated relationship with his first wife who went crazy, was committed and all this stuff. And I'm not saying that to justify. I'm actually saying this in a neutral sense. The neutral fact is that he had a human life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that to wink, wink. You can see me right now. I'm not winking at you. I'm winking at you sarcastically.
Exactly.
Because I think you understand where I'm coming from. On the raw essence, he had a human life susceptible to all the human things in that time period that we're mm-hmm. looking back on.
Right.
So I'm actually not even prepared or even care to say if Rafia Sakari is right or wrong in what she's saying.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying that if you're going to start initiating, you can't say this because we're, you know, because of Me Too or start signing that, I'm going to be like going, and I was like, I actually, you don't even know if I agree with you or not.
Mm-hmm.
in this imaginary conversation between me, feminist Ravi Zakaria, and T.S. Eliot, and Tim Breen. So that's kind of thing. I think it is very, very interesting. I actually am not, I'm not swayed in the slightest about my love for his work, because I will, I also have yet to read these letters myself. I hope they publish them, and I will buy that book and read it myself. Yeah.
In a heartbeat, and hopefully, you know, well, obviously he signed the letters, so we'll have his signature on it. So that's one thing I love is, you know, when I get somebody's book of poetry, I'm like, sign it, please, because, you know, it's personal. You wrote it for a reason, and it's personal like that. I was, you know, somebody asked me for my books, I make sure I always sign them. But yeah, do you think maybe it humanizes him a little bit to look at it in a thing, because I know for me, some of my heroes when I was younger, I would say probably in my 20s and early 30s, you know, I would hear a lot, I would idolize them, be like, oh yeah, no, yeah, whatever. But now, you know, for me, love Bukowski, but I can, you know, his stuff, I can, I don't worship the ground he walks on. I go, you know what? He was a bum. He was, did this, that, and the other thing. I can appreciate it, but it humanized. I mean, if I were to see him, I could talk to him, even keel. With T.S. Eliot, I still hold him up on a bit of a pedestal. This doesn't knock him down, but it makes it more attainable, I guess, is the thing that I'm going for. It's a thing that we don't know, you know, we didn't necessarily know about him. We didn't view him in this light. And it's more, he's less, I hate saying that he's less immortal because he's never immortal. His words are immortal, but the man himself obviously isn't. But for me, and again, I haven't read these letters, but for me, I think of it as, you know, he had this wife that was institutionalized and he was going through all this hardship while he's trying to make a living, while he's trying to go through the world. He's, you know, dealt this blow, and that humanizes him for me as well, because I know in my own life, I've, you know, had people like that, that, you know, have been damaged. I've been damaged, and, you know, just the thing of sticking with that person, until death do you part, really, you know, whatever sins he committed, he stayed with her for as long as he could. And, you know, kudos to him for that, because maybe in that day and age, in this day and age, a lot of people would not, they'd be like, oh, you're crazy like that. You need to be institutionalized. Later, I'm out the door. Divorce. See you later. Yeah. Of course, at the time, divorce was harder to get. I understand. But he stuck with it. He stuck it out as long as he humanly could. And I don't know how long I could have stuck out with it in dealing with the same circumstance. I don't know. But yeah, it makes it more human to me.
And in a way, it kind of amounts, like, I almost am processing what we're talking about. In a way, it's contributing to my kind of coming of age. It's almost also analogous to that, because when I read this article, and my takeaway was like, oh wow, it brings him out of this, you know, saintly, you know, mystical aesthetic kind of a person that people have been always referring to for a very long, you know, have been referring me to his work for a long time. And it's comforting from the sense that when you see that, it's almost like when I started living as an adult, you know, moved away at college and everything was done, you confront your ideas and notions about what life really is like get confronted with reality right away. Some people didn't have the luxury of being sheltered or shielded from the harsher blows of life growing up. I fortunately did. And then mid-20s, I'm like, oh, this is what happens in real life, you know, and then add, you know, marriage to that. I had my ideas and notions about marriage, and so did my wife. And 10 years, 11 years in, it's like we're still finding new places to start from, you know, and that's not a negative. That's actually mostly positive, because we end up saying, oh, we can trace why I did this, because I was just acting under the assumption that marriage was just a bunch of, you know, fancy kittens and rainbows and sunshine, or whatever way you want to dress it up without using specific details. But she was like, we both come to these points where we're just like, oh, wow, this is real life. And so this is one of those moments with where my notions and ideas of my heroes gets taken down a peg, or gets not getting taken down a peg. It just goes, it's brought down from the pantheon, or from Mount Olympus, or, you know, like from whatever elevated sphere of existence to, oh, they were just amazingly brilliant and complicated humans like everybody else. Well, maybe not everybody's amazingly brilliant, but I mean, like you said, everybody has an artistic kind of inclination inside them, and the way it expresses is different from person to person, and same thing here.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Wow. My brain is just buzzing tonight. I got to say, this is a fantastic conversation. I haven't had one of these in a while. And I definitely want to toss you, and I want your listeners to know, I just want to definitely toss you a good pat on the back here, because when I first saw you, because, you know, we're bringing all this stuff back to T.S. Eliot, but when I first saw you on your Instagram feed and all that kind of good stuff, I had tried to start off my first podcast way back in 2006, just like a regular poetry reading that I had been doing, you know, since 1993, 92, back in my Air Force days. And when I saw you, you know, reading other people's poetry, one thing for me is I read my poetry okay, but I got a good buddy down in Texas that reads my poetry like nobody's business. He and I are really close when we get tight like that. And when I saw you reading other people's poetry, I was like, now this is the stuff I was trying to do back in 2006. And this is the way it should be, you know, it should be done. So I definitely want to let your listeners know that, hey, Joel is doing it right. You know, from one poet to another, you are really bringing the love of the written word and the spoken word, because I think poetry should be spoken. Sung, what have you. It's great to have it on the page, but I get caught when I'm on my commuter train. I'll have the Paris Review or Poetry Magazine out, and I'll just start reading it out, and people are looking at me funny at, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning, this guy's reading poetry. Yeah. But I just wanted to thank you for doing what you do, and I want to encourage you to keep on doing it, and I want to encourage your listeners to, I don't know, keep encouraging Joel for doing what he's doing, because he's really doing you a service. So thank you and keep it up.
Well, thank you, Tim. I was really, really kind of you, and it's good to hear that. And I want to thank you for offering your time and your insight on this. It's funny because my gut instinct when we first connected through Instagram, and I saw you on my feed, I think it was through a comments thread that we first started, you know, like kind of touching base with each other. And then I remember early on just saying, all right, recommend me a couple of your episodes to go to just to first hear what was KDOI. Mm-hmm. What does that stand for? Remind me real quick.
That's Chemo's Den of Iniquity.
Chemo's Den of Iniquity. And I didn't know what that was until I listened to the first episode, and I got a chuckle. But the first episode I listened to was where you made a reference to your initial introduction to T.S. Eliot and the Hollow Man, the Hollow Man series. And I have to admit right now, I was tempted to read it, but I haven't yet read The Hollow Man yet because I wanted to experience it first through someone who's in who it was so important to. So I'm now going to go and do my homework and read The Hollow Man for the first time. And so when I heard that, going back to when I first listened to your podcast, it was like, damn, I knew I had a feeling about this guy, that he was – that not only would we have some similar overlapping tastes, but – I kept on hearing you talk, and you were talking to a gentleman, I forget his name, but about the prospect of endeavoring to write your first book and the whole process and kind of from the marketing and the business side of things. And you were saying things that I had heard, that I had thought and tried to say as well on my podcast. And one of the things that I remember was the idea that the answer isn't always just putting yourself in like isolation and writing. You said something to the effect of that you have to just go out and live life, knowing and trusting that you have this inclination to express yourself in poetry, and that'll be the most beneficial to your poem. And that's something I've reminded myself about, and I try to put it in like the commentary I do on my podcast and on live streams and in posts. And it was that episode that single-handedly was like, I knew my gut was right about this guy and we need to do something. And that's what we got to today. So thank you to you. Thank you to your listeners that are going to be listening to this joint effort. And I'm just so pleasantly surprised with the bass player connections. So many connections that just happened right in the recording of this very episode. Mm-hmm. And that, for me, that's one of the most – That's the way I like to move forward with projects and creativity is that kind of known connection that we even talked about a little bit today.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not blood. It's something in the brain or the head or the heart or the spirit or something. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So
absolutely.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that's it from my side. So this is Joel Anthony Chacha, the Hack Poet and Hack Sessions host, signing off with
Timothy Kim O'Brien with, well, formerly KDOI Podcasting, but now with Create Art Podcast, where we create more than you consume. So thank you, Joel, for it. And we will see you all respectively on our shows on our next episodes.